This is All In. I'm Jill Sheridan. Vaping has grown in popularity over the recent years. Some see e-cigarettes as a relatively safe alternative to tobacco, but reports on possible links between vaping and lung illness, as well as a small number of deaths, have a lot of people worried. Just last week, President Trump announced the Food and Drug Administration will move to force e-cigarette companies to stop selling flavored products, an attempt to lessen the appeal for young people. We'd love to hear from you. Are you worried about the health effects of vaping? Should certain elements of the product be banned? You can find us on Facebook and Twitter at All In Indiana. And joining me now in studio is Dr. Nadia Krupp, a pulmonologist at Riley Children's Health. Thank you so much for coming in today.
Thank you for having me.
So let's start with the basics. Vaping has been around now for a number of years, but it's definitely still a bit confusing for people to know exactly what is and how many products fit the term. Can you sort of help explain a little bit what we're talking about?
We are talking about aerosol products that typically contain nicotine, but not always. Juul is one of the more common brands, but anything that's considered an e-cigarette or a mini hookah or anything that involves putting an aerosol liquid into something that's then heated and inhaled is considered an e-cigarette product.
And they've certainly grown in the variety in just recent years.
Definitely. There are probably dozens of different iterations of what that looks like.
So you work as a pediatric pulmonologist, and you're seeing kids and teenagers, correct?
Yes.
So who do you see using these products? What does that age range look like?
Well, as far as the number of patients and children that are using these, it's anywhere between 20 and 25% of high schoolers are using these products fairly regularly, and about 12% are using them almost daily. Whether they report that to us when they come to the doctor's office is a different question. A lot of times they don't consider them to be nicotine products or e-cigarettes. They'll refer to it by a different name. We try to ask as many different ways as possible, but sometimes they just don't want to disclose that. And so we don't necessarily know which of our patients are using these. We just assume that a large proportion are.
And I've, you know, done some reporting on this in the past years. Every single year, we're seeing more and more of young people that are disclosing that they are using it.
And certainly the more we ask, the more they will disclose. And it's we are starting to see more people talk about it, which is very important.
So there's a lot we still don't know. But what do we know right now about the health effects of vaping? It sounds like, you know, we know more about the short term, of course, than the long term.
Yes. We are starting to see a lot more cases being reported of what is suspected to be vaping-associated pulmonary injury. VAPI is the abbreviation that's been coined in the medical literature. How severe that is varies a lot. Some people will just have some cough and chest congestion, maybe feel a little bit short of breath, but not really require any significant medical intervention. They just need time and they'll get better. All the way to people having respiratory failure and ending up on a ventilator for a week and a half, or even dying of the pulmonary complications of this. So it can span the entire spectrum. In the milder cases, I don't think we necessarily hear about nearly as much. We've heard about the hospitalized cases because those are the ones that tend to require the most medical attention and therefore come to the forefront.
Is it possible that these cases are being recognized more in young people because of their physiology?
It's possible, yes. We are seeing it in 16 and 17-year-olds as our number one age range at Riley. The physiology of a teenager compared to an adult is somewhat different. But by the time you get to your teenage years, your lungs have fully matured. One thing that's different about teenage physiology is that their addiction potential is even higher than an adult. And their usage of these products may be even higher than somebody who's of an adult age.
I mean, ultimately, that is the main concern,
right,
that we know nicotine is addictive and that we know for young people having addictive substances, mm-hmm, can have lifelong effects.
Yep. The adolescent brain is much more vulnerable to addiction than the adult brain. And so if you're we know that if you start smoking traditional cigarettes when you're a teenager, you're much more likely to be a lifelong smoker and have trouble quitting than if you start as an adult. That will be the case no matter what nicotine product you use, and that's one of the main concerns with these products being used in teenagers.
I know there's some research showing that, you know, even having, you know, these addictive substances could lead to other substance,
right,
abuse addictions down the line.
Exactly.
Certainly something that is concerning. So how much research has gone into finding some of these things out so far?
On the medical side of things, a lot of the research and publications that we've had so far have been centered on describing what this is and how to recognize it and how to treat it so that you can get people better and get them home. The research into what components of these devices and liquid products are causing this form of lung injury is still very much unknown. But within the medical literature, figuring out what we need to be evaluating for. Do we need to be looking for other organ systems being involved? We've had a couple cases that have involved liver and kidney injury as well. One of our patients had hallucinations and some issues with mental status that then resolved. But trying to spread the word amongst the medical community about not ignoring other organ systems and while we're focused so much on the lungs.
So when we hear about, you know, these health scares with vaping and a recent death in the state of Indiana of possible links to vaping and the lung illnesses that we're seeing, do you think that these scares and what are you hearing from, you know, parents and families who are concerned as more of these reports come out?
The more reports come out, the more we have parents ask and asking how to look for the signs of vaping-related lung illnesses and what to do about it. A lot of the questions that we're getting are from people in the community who are worried from a public health standpoint, how to educate and how to spread the word to not only parents but also teenagers and students. To try to curb this rapid rise that we're seeing in the use of these products.
Have you personally treated some of these cases?
Yes.
And what does it look like, you know, when you're looking at the symptoms and the actual person?
A lot of times it looks like a viral or flu-like illness. They start having some cough, maybe a little bit of chest pain, shortness of breath. They feel like they can't catch a full breath. That's a common complaint. Sometimes muscle aches, fatigue, nausea seems to be pretty common, and shakiness, some weakness. But a lot of times they don't have other signs of illness like fever or, say, nasal congestion, sinusitis type complaints. It's more respiratory and just kind of whole body not feeling well.
So, you know, we're starting to hear that some other substances might be put into, you know, these electronic vaping devices. That might be a concern. We're hearing from Beth on Facebook who asks, is vaping weed, THC, more dangerous than vaping nicotine? What do we know about what other products are coming in?
We do know that a significant number of the cases that have been reported as suspected vaping-related lung injury, people have reported using THC as well. What's unclear is the use of that THC what tipped them over to get sick or not? For some of the cases that we've had at Riley, they report that, yes, they have used THC in the past, but not for several months in the 2 to 3 months leading up to their illness, they'd only been using nicotine products. We've had other cases where they were using nicotine products and then more recently started using THC. So I don't think we know enough yet to know if THC is to blame for the majority of these cases or if a lot of it is just purely from the nicotine-containing products themselves.
Or possible other additives?
Or other additives.
What typically, you know, other questions are you hearing about from people that want to become more educated on a larger scale about, you know, vaping and e-cigarettes?
We hear from parents that they want to know, how do I know if my teenager is vaping or not? They're really easy to conceal. The vaping pens and vape pods are fairly small. A lot of them look like USB drives or other electronic devices. And so they're easy to mistake for something else. They also don't leave a lingering odor behind most of the time, like traditional cigarettes do. And so, unfortunately, it's fairly easy for people to use them surreptitiously. So we've had stories told of teenagers sitting in the back of the classroom and using vape pens during class, and while the teacher's back is turned, and the teacher has no way of seeing that because the cloud, the plume, has dissipated by the time they turn around.
And there's a recent federal push to get rid of all the flavors that might go into some of these products. Do you think that that's a good move for young people to avoid?
It's unclear whether removing the flavorings will actually curb teenagers using the product or not. We do know that a significant majority of teenagers are using flavored products currently. It's about 2/3 of them opt for a flavored product when they're using them. It's a different question to say, if you take out the flavoring, will they stop using it? I think it's going to take more than just one policy change or one initiative like that to fix this problem. It's going to take a lot of education and a lot of awareness about the cases that we're seeing to get people's attention.
And we will talk about some of those possible policies and ideas that are being bantered around. We really appreciate you coming in today. Dr. Nadia Krupp, pulmonologist at Riley Children's Health, IU Health. Can you stick around for the next segment?
Absolutely.
Fantastic. Again, we'll talk about some of those policies being looked at on a federal and state level concerning vaping. And we would love to hear from you, your questions and comments on social media. Should there be some kind of ban on e-cigarettes? Should the legal age to buy the products go up? We're on Facebook and Twitter at All in Indiana. I'm Jill Sheridan. Back in 2 minutes. This is All In. This is All In. I'm Jill Sheridan, and today for host Matt Pelser. And before we get back to our conversation on vaping, I want to tell you about our show earlier this week on addiction treatment. We heard about a clinic in Indiana that's marketing unproven treatments and what doctors and experts say about the complicated field of addiction research. You can find that podcast and all of our past shows at wfyi.org/allin. You can also find us on iTunes and Stitcher. Today we're talking about vaping. Health concerns have made headlines in recent weeks, and it's added urgency to some of the policy conversations around the issues. As always, we're taking your questions and comments on social media. Do you vape? Do you have children who do? Are you worried about its unknown long-term health effects? Find us on Facebook and Twitter at All in Indiana. And in the studio now, we welcome back Dr. Nadia Krupp, pulmonologist at Riley Children's Health at IU Health. Thanks for staying with us. And we're joined by Pam Pontonis, the Deputy Health Commissioner for the state of Indiana and the state epidemiologist. Thank you so much, Pam, for coming in. And Brian Hannon. Brian is Director of Government Relations at the American Cancer Society's Cancer Action Network. Welcome.
Thank you.
So, Pam, I'd like to start with you. You're the Deputy Health Commissioner, state epidemiologist here at the Indiana State Department of Health. Just a few short weeks ago, we saw the first death here in the state of Indiana from these lung injuries that are related to vaping. What have you seen so far in terms of other health issues that are tied to vaping in the state of Indiana?
What we've seen so far are symptoms that include shortness of breath, cough, difficulty breathing, pneumonia, some gastrointestinal symptoms, and the respiratory symptoms can become progressively worse. Many of our cases, most of our cases actually, have been hospitalized and can even reach the point where they require a ventilator to help them breathe.
And so these cases that the state is seeing are all age ranges as well.
Yes, the cases that we have investigated so far range in age from 16 to 65 years, the majority of which actually are ages between ages 16 and 29.
And so how urgent is this for the state of Indiana? I mean, we are hearing, again, these reports and have a lot of people worried.
at this point, we don't know exactly what's causing these illnesses. So certainly that is reason for concern. We are working in conjunction with other states and as well as the CDC and the FDA to try to learn much more, as much as we can, about these cases, what is causing the illnesses, the severity of disease, and what might be contributing to the illness.
So, Brian, I know that you're very plugged into this issue and are really aware of what's happening, you know, on the statewide level. With the American Cancer Society, what is the position right now for the society on e-cigarettes and vaping?
Well, we would really love to see the FDA take, the Food and Drug Administration, take more action to, within their existing authority, to rein in some of these products. There is a proposal right now that they're working on to take the flavored e-cigarette products off of the shelves. We don't know what that looks like yet, whether that includes all of the flavors, what products it will include. We know that, you know, there's a reason fruit-flavored cigarettes don't exist. That's because the FDA had at some point made a point to take those off the shelves. We think the same thing should happen for e-cigarette products. But there are also other policy changes that states should be considering, and those are things we continue to talk to lawmakers about, whether it's raising the age for sale of tobacco products in Indiana from 18 to 21, making sure those laws are well enforced, providing more funding for prevention and cessation programs, implementing taxes. There are, as Dr. Krupp said in the last segment, there are really probably many policy changes we are going to have to pursue if we're going to effectively address the problem.
You know, the flavors are something that I've heard, you know, some small business owners of vape shops and, you know, really speaking out against, and other people that, you know, say that vaping has helped them quit traditional tobacco. And we know that, you know, there has been some reports that it's possibly safer than traditional tobacco, and some people upset about, you know, that having those flavors gone. Do we have that research? Do we know that, you know, it is somewhat safer or not than traditional cigarettes?
I think it's safe to say we really don't know the long-term consequences of using these products. There may be some marginal benefit if adult cigarette users are able to fully switch to an electronic device, but we are not seeing that data right now that that's happening. In fact, what we're seeing is more youth pick up this product and enter a lifetime of nicotine addiction rather than adults using it to quit. So I think policymakers really need to weigh that balance and understand that maybe folks are providing some anecdotal evidence and personal stories of how they've helped – these products have helped them quit cigarettes. But we're not seeing that borne out in kind of peer-reviewed empirical data yet. And I think we need to be cognizant of that as we draft policies, that it's probably – we need to have a bias toward protecting youth right now.
I've heard, you know, many people say that, you know, we're undoing all these years of good work that we had done, you know, as far as getting people to quit tobacco now with the e-cigarette and vaping epidemic. So, Brian, again, is there, you know, any – do you think there's any policy that's really important that we need to focus on, or is it, like Dr. Krupp said, a combination of things that we really have to implement?
I think it's probably a combination of things. We've seen a few states – well, Michigan right now has in recent days taken action to ban flavors. This is something the Ohio governor is considering, the state of New York. Several communities have done this. We continue to think it's probably best done at the federal level, but the absence of action at the federal level, states should consider it. I think in the immediate term for Indiana policymakers, as we look ahead to the 2020 legislative session, what could be accomplished there, I think raising the age from 18 to 21 makes a lot of sense. Several states across the country have done this. Hundreds of municipalities across the country have done this. It seems to be going in that direction, and I think that that's a worthwhile policy proposal for them to take up and pass next year. We'd like to make sure that's well enforced and that retailers are actually held accountable. If we say you can't sell to anyone under 21, we need to make sure that's actually being enforced in the state. But we need to complement it, as we said earlier, with some other issues. Lawmakers this fall will look at the benefits of taxing these products, e-cigarette products and e-liquids. That is something we're giving guidance on. We think it could be part of the solution. As I mentioned earlier, providing more funding to the state's prevention and cessation program, which has really been woefully underfunded for several years now. It's down, you know, $25 million from where its high water mark several years ago. So in the face of a new nicotine addiction challenge with our kids, I think it's high time for lawmakers to boost the funding for those kinds of programs.
Certainly it's been a challenge at the State House, though, getting some of these policies implemented in the past. With this recent epidemic, do you think that there's more momentum now possibly?
I think, yes, this opens a conversation. This is the kind of the explosion of e-cigarette use amongst kids in Indiana and across the country, and now the onset of these hundreds of kind of acute lung illnesses that we're seeing across the country has put this, I think, front and center for many lawmakers. That's good, and I think we should address these products. I think we should also continue to remind lawmakers we haven't dealt adequately with our old regular combustible tobacco products in this state. We still are one of the worst states in the country for those kinds of products. So we need a comprehensive across-the-board package of solutions to these policies. And I think that we're getting closer to getting some movement in the State House, and I hope that's true, not just in 2020, but in the years ahead.
So the one policy we are talking about, you know, banning the flavors, I've heard some talk. Are you worried that, you know, a ban on these would simply push these flavors into an illegal market, which happens with other drugs all the time, and possibly even get young people involved in, you know, criminal behavior? Is that a concern?
Well, I suppose some black market issues could always be a concern. But as was mentioned earlier, a majority of kids – I mean, the reason largely that we've had flavored tobacco products on the market and that they've been successful is because they appeal to children and kids more than – an adult. And so I think it can be part of the solution. I think the benefits of taking these flavors off the market for e-cigarettes, but also why not reopen this issue for menthol cigarettes or some other flavored cigars, for instance, which we know appeal to youth. I think that should be part of the solution, and I think the benefits of doing that far outweigh any potential risks or considerations we may have on black market activity.
Pam, the state recently launched an awareness and education campaign directed at young people. Is that going to be really a critical part of solving this?
Yes, it is a critical part. And the Indiana State Department of Health joined Governor Holcomb in August, who announced a three-pronged approach to address youth vaping. And it focuses on three areas. One, education and training for students, schools, and parents. This work includes peer-to-peer education, school assemblies, conferences, online trainings, and more that really focus on prevention and cessation. The approach also includes a text to quit feature, as well as a statewide public awareness campaign called Behind the Haze, which will be launching soon. Indiana State Department of Health has also developed a new website, vapefreeindiana.isdh.in.gov, to provide resources for these efforts for healthcare providers, for schools, for parents, to really get critical, important, and evidence-based information at their fingertips. We're investing more than $2 million in this effort to increase awareness and really help prevent the next generation of smokers from developing, and whether that's traditional combustible cigarettes or e-cigarettes and vaping. So it really, we feel, is a critical part of our effort to get information out that is sound, that is science-based, and make sure that people have the information that they need.
Dr. Krupp, do you think an education campaign like this can really make a difference?
I think so, especially if it can involve teenagers teaching other teenagers and telling their stories. Across adolescent medicine, teenagers are much less likely to listen to us as adults as they compared to listening to a peer of theirs. So involving peer-to-peer and involving schools and going out to where teenagers are and meeting them where they're at, if that's a significant component, that's going to go a lot further.
And you can find us on Facebook and Twitter and comment at All in Indiana. We're hearing from Sammy on Twitter, who writes, I graduated from high school this year and unfortunately watched people get addicted to Juuls. He's been asked countless times if he had any pods, or she, I'm not sure. How did Juul get its foothold with teens? Sammy wants to know. You know, when did this all begin? It does seem like it sort of crept up on us. Mm-hmm. We weren't ready.
There were other e-cigarette companies that had been around for quite a while. Juul, however, I think got a foothold in the market in part because of just its design and how cool it looks, and availability and some of the flavors, and you could buy some of the flavored products online, and it has some slickness factor that some of the others lacked. So that was part of it. And part of it was honestly marketing and some marketing practices that seem to, whether it's intentional or not, you can ask the Juul company people, but it did seem to appeal to youth and how it was initially marketed. So Juul did get a large lion's share. I think over 80% of the e-cigarette market was Juul at one point, and probably still is. And then it's become almost normal amongst high schoolers now.
Do you see that, Brian? Real problem with the marketing?
Yeah, it's been predatory marketing. There are early examples, but when Juul was first coming into the market, of them going into schools and kind of promoting their products to kids under the guise of educational programs or tobacco prevention programs. But these aren't new tactics. I mean, these are the same tactics big tobacco cigarette manufacturing companies used years ago to hook kids. There are still fewer restrictions today on how e-cigarettes are marketed. You see e-cigarettes marketed on the radio and on, television, on billboards in a way that cigarettes aren't. So there's still a lot of work to be done in the regulatory space on reining these kinds of marketing promotions in as well. They are not blameless. I think, I guess my opinion would be that this was very intentional, and it's a tactic out of a playbook we've seen before.
Ben from Facebook writes, 480,000 Americans die a year from combustible tobacco products. If you take away flavored vapor products, you're dooming millions of Americans back to deadly tobacco or creating a huge black market. Again, we've touched on, some of these issues. Are these real concerns, do you think, Pam?
What we know right now with the vaping illnesses that we have seen is that this is new, and it is a very rapidly evolving situation. We don't know, in fact, what is exactly causing these illnesses. We do know that in a very short span of time, the numbers of cases that we have seen both in Indiana and nationwide have increased rapidly. And there have currently been 7 deaths reported. The urgency for us is that we don't know the cause behind this. We don't know the long-term effects. And that's what we're really trying to find out right now that is very important from a public health perspective so that we can get an education out to folks. We can inform them of how they can prevent these kinds of illnesses. We currently have 46 cases in Indiana that we are investigating, and I think over 500 now nationwide. So it's really critical that we are able to work with our other states, work with our federal partners to help determine a cause of these illnesses so that we can prevent them.
We know that, some organizations, schools are dealing with this in their own way, trying to help students who are vaping. It's a lot easier to do that, maybe on a small scale. Do you think, that those moves are good? I mean, should schools be trying to take matters into their own hands?
I think yes. I think any effort to try to educate and reinforce this information to the people who are affected by it is welcome. The other thing that I would add to the question that you got mm-hmm. through Facebook is that the cases that we're seeing in young people, at least at Riley, the teenagers, these are people who are vaping who probably would not have otherwise been nicotine users. It's not that they would have been combustible cigarette users and instead they're vaping. These are people who are using these products who likely not all of them would have gone on to use something else.
Well, so much to talk about. And I really want to thank all of you for coming in today. Brian Hannon, Director of Government Relations, American Cancer Society's Cancer Action Network, Pam Pontonis, Deputy Health Commissioner at the Indiana State Department of Health, and Dr. Nadia Krupp, pulmonologist at Riley Children's Health. Again, thank you all so much.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Up next, a recent conversation that I had with Jeremy Turner, Director of HIV and STV DD Viral Hepatitis Division. We're taking a little bit of a turn here. And Indiana State Department of Health, and also Jason Grissel, President and CEO of the Health Foundation of Greater Indianapolis, and this ahead of the annual AIDS Walk in Indianapolis. We will continue the vaping conversation online. You can find us at Twitter and Facebook, All in Indiana. I'm Jill Sheridan. Back in 2 minutes. This is All In. Here on All In, we welcome Jeremy Turner, Director, HIV-STD Viral Hepatitis Division at the Indiana State Department of Health, and Jason Grissel, President and CEO of the Health Foundation of Greater Indianapolis. Thank you so much for joining us today as we're talking about this upcoming AIDS Walk here in Indiana and the larger issue of HIV and AIDS in the state of Indiana. Jeremy, I'd like to start with you first. Tell us about the work that the state is doing right now as far as treatment and prevention when it comes to HIV and AIDS.
You know, it's great to be here today, and it's such a fantastic opportunity for us to talk about the AIDS Walk and how much it means to our state, and really what Hoosiers have been through since the beginning of the epidemic. For over 3 decades, we've been engaged in the fight against HIV in Indiana, and our system is pretty unique. The state made an early investment in what they called community action groups, or what we refer to as CAGs. And many of these organizations grew up to be the HIV service agencies that are still providing care to about 13,000 people across the state who are infected with HIV here in Indiana. And so we have a lot of great opportunities to help people in so many different ways. Nowadays, we understand the importance of social determinants of health and making sure that people's needs are met in a variety of different ways to keep them healthy and happy. But one of the things that we deal with are restrictions on federal funding sources about how we can serve people. And that's what makes the walk so important. The money that we raise goes to support the Direct Emergency Financial Assistance Fund at Indiana AIDS Fund, which is administered by the Health Foundation of Greater Indianapolis. And agencies are able to use these dollars to help people living with HIV in creative ways and to address specific concerns that might have fallen through the cracks in what might be eligible through federal sources. So it really is a great day for us and a fantastic opportunity to also highlight the fact that we are gearing up to end the epidemic here. We now have the tools that it's going to take that we hope within the next 10 years that we can stop the spread of HIV and keep people living with HIV from ever progressing to AIDS. So really, really dynamic time in our field.
It is pretty incredible, the advances in medication, especially for people living with HIV. Talk a little bit about some of those advances. I mean, it's remarkable just in the last 5 years.
Absolutely. Well, one of the biggest things to happen here in the past decade, they've approved a once-a-day pill. It's a prescription that's made by Gilead that is able to essentially keep people from being infected as long as they take their medicine every day. And so that's called pre-exposure prophylaxis, or PrEP. We have a lot of great community partners that have done a lot of campaigning around making sure that the public is aware of that great prevention option. But we now also know, and the CDC has embraced, that when people living with HIV have suppressed viral loads and they reach what they call an undetectable status, that they are not able to transmit that infection. You can kind of see the path forward there. When we have a great biomedical prevention option with a once-a-day pill that will prevent HIV, and we know that when people living with HIV are having good access to care, that they can maintain viral suppression, and when they reach undetectable, that they aren't able to transmit. And so it just really, with those two things combined, we can see an end to this.
Now, Jason, Jeremy touched on it a little bit, but I know that, you know, the walk is really directly supporting some of these social factors, these social determinants that are determining whether or not people are getting care or having these preventative measures. Is that true? Can you talk about some of those?
Sure. So the Indiana AIDS Walk, you know, the DEFA Fund, the Direct Emergency Financial Assistance Fund, has been around since the late 90s. This year, the walk is in its 31st year, which is exciting. And also, it's memorable in that we're still in this fight 31 years later. The DEFA Fund, historically, like Jeremy alluded to, you know, it helps fill the gaps for clients living around the state of Indiana that have emergencies come up, and if there's a choice to be made between paying their rent or getting their medications that month, whether that's utilities, transportation, that is what the DEFA Fund is for. It's not meant to sustain anyone. On average, I like to say it's about $300 a client. You know, maybe a client has a $50 need and another client has an $800 need. It sort of runs the gamut. But an example of an opportunity, there was some emergency financial assistance provided to a client. This particular client was wheelchair bound. It was an electronic wheelchair, and the battery died. And there wasn't any other means to purchase that replacement battery for this client, so they were basically homebound to the extent of the length of their extension cord so that they could move around their place. So DEFA provided that replacement battery and got that client back engaged in care, back engaged in society, to the grocery, to the doctor's office, the pharmacy, back outside for vitamin D. I mean, there's a holistic approach that we definitely embrace with DEFA. And it, in general, it covers physician visits, medications, insurance copays, dental services, optical, rent, mortgage, utilities, transportation, nutrition. And then there's some other expenses, whether that's maybe someone needs a copy of their birth certificate to be able to apply for insurance. DEFA will help secure those benefits by being able to purchase that birth certificate.
You know, that client, too, just to follow up on that story, I was actually one of the service providers who was involved with this client's care. And when we talk about quality of life, they were on Medicaid and they were in an institution where they didn't qualify to have that battery replaced on their wheelchair. And really the thing that was affected most was that this client relied on a support group meeting once a week for a social opportunity. And that was pretty much the only time that they ever got to interact with their peers. And losing that caused the client's health to decline even faster. And he really did not live much longer after we got his chair fixed. But seeing him roll through the door that first day that he was able to come back into the center, it was just so amazing because he really had gotten quite down in the dumps, you know, very depressed and isolated. And it just made such a huge difference. And that was $100. That battery was $100. And so when we talk about raising funds, every little bit counts. And, you know, there were so many times I had the joy of being a housing program manager that administers the Indiana AIDS Fund grant at one of the largest agencies in the state. And, you know, there were moms who were so concerned about being able to afford school uniforms for their kids. And so, you know, the kinds of things that keep people up late at night, think about having a chronic illness, a serious disease like HIV, and you are, you know, worrying about being able to not only keep yourself healthy, but all of the other things that come along with life. And so you're trying to balance, you know, buying your medications and making bills and all of those kinds of usual things. And, you know, on top of that, those little things and having just a little bit of help can help people breathe easier, can relieve their anxiety. And that just has so much of an impact on people's overall health.
I think maybe people, you know, miss that sometimes that, you know, it might be a utility bill. It might be, you know, trouble with their lease or so many other factors that are playing into health. So this is encouraging to hear that this fund directly supports those types of things. You know, you mentioned you're in your 31st year. Mm-hmm. A lot has changed in the course of HIV and AIDS in the state of Indiana in those 31 years. What do you think most has changed?
I think one of the things that's been the biggest change has been a positive outlook for the future. You know, originally, a lot of the AIDS service organizations that were created, you know, were primarily there as a social network for families and for the individuals to help prepare them to die. And now, you know, so much has changed with biomedical changes and new medications. And now we have these prevention methods to help keep people from becoming infected with HIV. You know, the outlook is bright. People are living much longer lives. Chances are someone that's HIV infected, that's in care, undetectable viral load, will live a normal lifespan and will probably die of something else, heart disease or, you know, something that's going to probably kill the rest of us as well. And that is, it's reassuring. It's a bright spot. But the fight is still there, you know, to help prevent new infections and keep people that are living with the infection in care, access to care, good quality care, making sure they can afford their medications. It is a struggle for folks, especially that may be underinsured or in a low-income situation. We need to help figure out ways to ensure that they get the care that they need.
Yeah, Jeremy, what do you think are some of the barriers? I mean, there's lots of barriers when we're talking about ending the epidemic, and we're really trying to address, you know, every single person and their needs.
Well, when we talk about everything that we've learned as we've worked to address HIV, that one of the biggest things that we know is that the virus has impacted different groups throughout the course of the epidemic. And so, you know, we're at a time now when there are health disparities, the same health disparities that we see in many other areas, whether it's heart disease, other chronic illnesses, how they disproportionately impact communities of color, how they disproportionately impact people who are living in poverty. HIV is following that same trend. And so the same barriers that we deal with in overall health, you know, we need to overcome with HIV. And one of the things that we are making sure of is that as we talk about ending the epidemic, that we are making sure that everyone is included in our planning and that we are intentional about acknowledging the fact that disparities do exist and working to eliminate any barriers that there are for any community, because we want all the ships to rise together in this fight. And so we're seeing some good early progress already, and I think that we're going to get there. But there is a lot of effort being made to make sure nobody gets left behind in this. I also would like to kind of follow up one thing. As we talk about things that have transpired, like the Scott County outbreak, many of our agencies were formed by grassroots community efforts to serve the general face of the epidemic, which are largely driven by men who have sex with men. And as we are experiencing more transmission occurring among people who inject substances, we also are keeping that in mind to make sure that we are creating relevant programs, because communities that we serve need to see themselves reflected in the service providers. And there needs to be a culture for the agencies that are created around the needs of those clients. And so as we are seeing more diversity among the people who are living with HIV, whether that diversity comes from their risk behaviors or whether that diversity comes from the different communities that they might be representing, different subpopulations, you know, really going the extra step and making sure that we are providing and equipping all of the agencies out in the field with what they need to be good service providers.
And what they need can look very differently from one place to another.
Absolutely. You know, I started in this field in Evansville in the early 2000s, and our Evansville clients are different than our Fort Wayne clients and are different from the South Bend clients. And, you know, there's definitely we have some very rich, amazing communities here that have very different identities. And so I love it. I'm native Hoosier. I call myself a Hoosier exceptionalist, and I think that we have some exceptional people out there, and I wouldn't want to end the epidemic with any other group. Getting the chance to work with the physicians, the social workers, the case managers, the outreach workers, it really is just a unique opportunity to be engaged in the fight at this point in time with the people we have at the table now.
About how many cases do you know, the new cases, does Indiana see a year?
There are about 500 people who find out their HIV status each year. The total number of people is just shy of 13,000 people that we know about living in Indiana right now. I had talked about those folks accessing care, but only about half of the people with HIV in Indiana are accessing some kind of service from our federal sources or, you know, but the agencies are there to assist anyone who needs it. And, you know, there's eligibility criteria that go into that as far as what is available. But even if it's just for a support group setting, we have a variety of HIV service agencies located in care regions across the state that are standing by there just to help out in any way that they can. And they estimate that about 87% of people with HIV in Indiana do know their status. And so if you think about it, in those terms, we only have a couple thousand people, statistically speaking, that we're looking for. And we know that most new transmission occurs among people who don't yet know their status. And so as we continue to identify greater numbers of people, and we, you know, raise that bar up to the 90-95% range of people who are positive knowing their status, then we would expect to see a lot less transmission occur.
So the Direct Emergency Financial Assistance Fund serves about 2,000 Hoosiers a year. Is that correct?
In 2018, the DEFA Fund served 4,853 Hoosiers.
And you have a goal this year during the walk.
Our goal this year is to raise $225,000. That is on par with what we've been able to raise the last few years. We've also had the fortune, the privilege of being able to apply for a matching grant the last couple years. So in 2019, our active DEFA grants actually equaled about $285,000. We don't always bank on getting that matching grant, but we're super grateful when we do. So we're hoping to raise $225,000 this year. And it's important to note that without the support of the Health Foundation of Greater Indianapolis, the walk wouldn't be as successful as it has been. Last year, 95 cents of every dollar raised went out in grants because the Health Foundation supports a lot of the administrative expenses, the staff time related to producing the walk and making it happen. So, you know, it's through the generosity of the Health Foundation that the DEFA Fund has been able to do as much work as it has.
And how many people are expected of the walk, and can people still join?
People can still join. They can register at IndianaAIDSWalk.org, and we're hoping for 300 to 400 people this Sunday.
I'd imagine the walk is a celebration of sorts, you know, for how far we have come. But still, there is a lot of misinformation, a lot of stigma surrounding HIV and AIDS. And that's something that we still have to work on.
Absolutely. We have so much stigma left. And, you know, it just really, we have to make sure as we are working to end the epidemic that we are doing everything that we can to address stigma, because it really is going to be one of those barriers that keep us from success. There are so many tools that we have. If we employ them properly, we're going to get there more quickly. If we allow stigma to determine the kinds of decisions that we're going to make about what kind of interventions we're providing or how we're trying to serve people in different places, we need to make sure that everyone has the same kind of access and that we use good science-based decision-making as we press forward with this ending the epidemic plan.
Thank you both so much for joining today.
Thank you.
Thank you.
The AIDS Walk is Sunday, September 22nd. I'm Jill Sheridan, in for host Matt Pelser, who will return next week on All In.